Okay, well, thank you for, I want to thank the organizers for not only inviting me to speak here, but to enjoy the Santa Barbara weather for a little while longer than that. I'm going to talk about, as Tamar said, bounds on turbulent transport. This is going to be a review of work that's been done over the last almost decade or so. A lot of collaborators, Peter Constantine being a prime one, you will see. There. So specifically, what I want to talk about is to review these results for limits on bulk transport in solutions of the Navier-Stokes equations. And the purpose of doing a study like this is because these limits that come out of here, or these bounds, they don't involve any secondary assumptions. So you can't argue, if you don't argue with this, then you can't argue with the results. You may not like them or be satisfied with them, but you can't argue with them. And the surprising things, which maybe has some physics in them, is that turbulent flows, in some cases, tend to saturate these bounds, so that there's maybe a hint of some kind of variational principle here. In fact, that idea goes back to Malkus in the 50s, who proposed that, in some sense, turbulence might be something which does try to maximize, in his case, he was thinking about convection, heat transport, but generally speaking, transport. That was mathematically formulated by Lou Howard in the 60s, based on Navier-Stokes equations with statistical assumptions, and the groups around Howard and Busse developed those things a lot. The results I'm going to talk about don't have any secondary assumptions like statistical assumptions, although there is overlap with this stuff. Yeah. Now, the bait and switch is that actually I'm mostly going to talk about epsilon, the energy dissipation rate, but as many of you know, in many cases, transport of mass, momentum, and or heat is proportional to epsilon, so a bound on one is a bound on the other. And I've also written this as grad u squared, but all of the problems I'll talk about will be where that's just the rate of strain. It's regular old epsilon, nothing fancy. And the brackets mean space-time average, so this is long-time average. Now, as Peter just said, we don't know much about Navier-Stokes, but we do know a kinetic energy equation. And the kinetic energy equation tells us that the kinetic energy is finite for all times, and the time-averaged energy dissipation rate, or integrals of the energy dissipation, are finite. So this is one of the few things that we do know a priori exists for solutions of Navier-Stokes equations. So I'm going to talk about three specific classes of problems here where we have results with varying degrees of success and insight. First, I'll talk about Navier-Stokes with a body force but no boundaries. And that's actually a relatively new result, but it's actually turns out to be a pretty elementary calculation, but I won't do the calculation. Then I'll talk about Navier-Stokes with boundaries but no body force. And then I'll talk about when we have body forces and boundaries. I'm going to. You'll see the results. You have to see the results, right? Right. No, this is what it's defined as. So that's the definition, and now I'll tell you exactly what I mean here. So the case that most closely resembles something that would be homogeneous isotropic turbulence would be a situation where I'm forcing the Navier-Stokes equation with the body force. Now, I've got it time independent. We could change this and put time in there, but just for simplicity, I'll leave it like that. And I don't have any boundaries anyplace. And the idea is that my fluid is contained in a big box of size L, which I would like to take to infinity. To really be homogeneous and isotropic, I would like to have an infinite volume problem. But my force is then being my force is being applied on a scale of length little l here. So this is sort of the picture of the thing. So the fluid field is periodic only with the large period, but the forcing function is periodic there. That means, of course, I'm forcing at an intermediate wave number in there. Now, the theoretical, experimental, and DNS expectations are that epsilon, the energy dissipation rate per unit mass, ought to look like have two contributions. Well, if the viscosity is large or the Reynolds number is small, then there's a laminar-like dissipation term, which is viscosity times the square of the rate of strain, which typically speaking would be some RMS velocity squared divided by some relevant length squared. On the other hand, as viscosity goes to zero, there should be a residual dissipation because of the cascade and so on. And so there should be some constant which doesn't depend upon anything, or much anyway, times, dimensionally, there has to be something which only depends on the velocity and the length scale, and it's u cubed over L. And in fact, Srini, the several decades ago last century, Srini, who makes you sound old, collected a bunch of experimental data from, this was from wind tunnels or grid turbulence, and he plotted epsilon times LF, which is some relevant length scale in the driving, divided by the RMS velocity cubed, as a function of here R lambda, and you can see at low Reynolds numbers it's decreasing like this, but then it comes out to an order one, saturates to an order one constant. That's the residual dissipation. Oh, just to show that it's supposed to be it's just constant. This becomes saturates to something that doesn't change, right? To guide the eye, to put a little color in the slide. Okay, well, here's two more lines anyway. And again, just to guide the eye. What Srini did, now this is more recently, still last century though, he collected, this is from DNS data. So here's epsilon L over U cubed. Now here his L, Srini took, you had just the velocity fields, right? So you had to get a length scale out of the velocity field. So he defined a length scale based on the energy spectrum. But anyway, you get the same kind of behavior. At low Reynolds number, it decreases and it saturates to something. I think one of the conclusions from this was that the level at which it saturates here may depend upon the nature of the forcing, on the details of the forcing that drives the turbulence. Yeah. Okay? So here's the theorem, which is quite new. Actually, Cyprian Foyash in 97 showed me really how to do this, and then I just cleaned things up a bit. But the fact of the matter is that epsilon, for this setup, is less than or equal to the following quantity. Nu times the RMS velocity squared divided by a length scale squared, which I'll define below, times viscosity plus u cubed over a different length scale. Now, u is just the RMS velocity, as I said. This laminar length scale here is defined by these ratios of moments of the forces. And now, if you had a narrow band force, then this length scale is precisely the length scale of that narrow band. You can write that in terms of the spectrum of the force if you want and convince yourself that that's the case. Pick any n. Pick n. Hey, you like 5? Pick 5. Yeah. Then this is true for n equals 5. It's also true for n equals 7. It's also true for n equals minus. Yeah, you can minimize. For a given f, you could minimize over n. In fact, that's what one would do. If one wanted to pick a particular f, then you could minimize over n and see if things changed. But for narrow band forces, these are just going to give the same answer anyway. This turbulent length scale is defined slightly differently, but it's also something which only depends upon the length scales and the force. It does not depend upon the intensity of the force. It doesn't depend upon the box size. So we do have this situation now where we have a bound on epsilon, which agrees with the intuition. This doesn't depend upon the box size, and this doesn't depend upon the box size. Oh, no, this is not a... This is a theorem. Yeah, it requires a calculation. Right. No, it's not obvious. And that's why I'm happy with it, because it's something that needs to be shown, and it can be shown. So this means I can take the infinite volume limit here. Sure. So the L that is here, these L's depend upon the length scale and the force, not the length scale of the box. Right. Now, that's the per unit mass, the volume average. Right. Yeah, it's the energy dissipation rate per unit mass. So that's the average density of energy dissipation in the box. So that means this has a good thermodynamic limit, if you will. I can take the volume to infinity holding all these other things fixed. Yeah. Okay. Now, also, this is true in 2D. Also, I don't know whether, because we were talking about 2D and inverse cascades, but this theorem holds in every dimension also. So, no. There are no constants here, but it depends upon how you want to. You might want to reset these, and then that would introduce constants out there. But you can evaluate them, right? Okay. So that's, I think that's a little bit satisfying, right? That and that it turns out this calculation, I won't do it now, but it's very elementary. No, I don't assume, say, I take the infinite time average. And this is an upper bound on all possible long time averages. That's why I mentioned this, to make somebody ask that question. But it's still finite. The long time average is still finite. Yeah. This is, yeah. Oh, yeah, okay. Well, I want to go on to a different topic, so I don't want to, Okay, so, but then people will think about that, but I want to change the subject. Okay, quit thinking about that. Right. Okay, now let me talk about situation with boundaries but no body force. Okay, boundaries with no body force is just Navier-Stokes, where it's the boundary conditions that are driving the flow. Perhaps one of the simplest ways of thinking about this is a shear flow, the setup for plain couette, or turbulent couette in this case. I'm going to shear the layer of thickness h with a speed u here. The Reynolds number is defined not in terms of r lambda or something like this. When I talk about Reynolds number, I mean the thing that's controlled externally by the experimentalist here. Now, the theoretical or experimental expectations for a problem like this would be, the conventional wisdom now is represented, although I'm not trying to defend any particular closure model, but it's certainly represented by the Prandtl von Karman logarithmic friction law, which has asymptotics at large values of the Reynolds number or small values of the viscosity, that epsilon goes like u cubed over h, so it looks like there's a residual dissipation, but it's got a 1 over log Reynolds number squared decrease. That's just the asymptotics of when you compute the dissipation in Prandtl von Karman. Where's the bucket? Here. Hershey bar. Okay, so here are data, experimental data, which show this. In fact, these are the old version of the data Harry Swinney showed on Monday. But the new data looks like this, only those little noises is gone, basically. And this is torque versus Reynolds number in a turbulent couette flow experiment. These data are very well fit, at least above about 10 to the fourth, by the logarithmic friction law, which has this asymptotics corresponding to epsilon goes like u cubed over h with the log correction there. And just for comparison, that's the laminar dissipation down there. And I do want to leave this up. And I'll come back to that. Thank you, sir. Thank you. Now, the theorem here, we do some analysis that was inspired by a mathematical method developed by Hopf in 41, and Peter and I first proved this in 92, and then the best prefactor has been obtained by Nicodemus Grossman and Holthaus in 98, that epsilon is less than or equal to u cubed over h times a prefactor, which is computable, and turns out to be about 0.011. And if you put that actual rigorous bound on top of these data, it's not bad for functional analysis. That's actually where it falls with respect to the data. So an a priori bound, for example, at Reynolds number of about a million, the analysis puts us within an order of magnitude of the experimental value there. Now, something that we've looked for quite a bit is to see whether or not we could find this logarithmic correction here. And we haven't been able to find it, but what we have been able to discern is that a logarithmic correction to this residual dissipation here is pretty sensitive to about everything. For example, if we modify the problem a little bit by, besides shearing the layer, we put a little injection of fluid on the top and suction on the bottom, so the boundary conditions are just slightly changed like this. So now there's this parameter theta, which parameterizes how much injection and suction we have. Then a recent theorem by Ed Spiegel and Rodney Worthing and myself, is that, well, first of all, this is barely a theorem. It's just an exact, we found a very elementary exact solution that has the energy dissipation rate as viscosity goes to zero, goes to U cubed over H times a constant that depends upon theta, and that constant is non-zero. What that means is that this scaling, then for the exact solution, it looks like the upper bound, and we get an upper bound which looks just like this, which means that in the analysis, there's no better we can do. We could never find logarithms or anything in the analysis because we have an exact solution which then provides a lower bound on the upper bound, and it's saturated. So that means that with regard to the scaling with the viscosity and the vanishing viscosity limit, this technique, at least for this problem, is sharp. Yeah. Yes? It could be. It could be. However, the same statement applies, that in general, the analysis, if we modify the problem a tiny bit, there can't be anything. There can't be logarithms. There can't be a small power law, right? That it's sharp there. Yeah. As theta goes to zero, that's right. That's right. That's why we can't get the lower bound in this situation here. Okay. Now, there's another physical example where modifying the problem just a little bit makes a big difference in the results, and that's to roughen the boundaries. And so here I will mention some experimental... Yeah? I mean that this result, no upper bound can be below this, because this is an exact solution, right? And the upper bound looks like this, agrees with it, with respect to the scaling with nu, right? So there cannot be any hidden Reynolds number dependences in there, because the Reynolds number has nu in it. That's what I mean by sharp. I'm not assuming anything. I don't add it. It's sharp. There's no assumptions. This is correct. This is the correct answer. This is the answer. There's an exact solution which agrees with the upper bound. Turbulence is... But no. No. Okay. Yes, the upper bound is true with suction also. Actually, turbulence in principle could be below this laminar dissipation, but there's issues about that we've thought about. Okay, rough boundaries. If you take the same shear flow, and this was an experiment done by a number of people in France, and including our distinguished Professor Tsinober participated here. What they did was repeated the turbulent Couette flow experiment, something like Lathrop, Feinberg, and Swinney's experiment, but then they added some ribs to it. And when they plot epsilon times L over U cubed, that's their beta, versus Reynolds number, well, this is the logarithmic decrease, and here's their data for smooth walls, but when you add those ribs, they get precisely a saturation, a residual dissipation, and an epsilon looks like about 0.015 U cubed over H. So it gives that scaling. The conclusion is that if you perturb these smooth wall shear flow problems in these two cases, either mathematically perturb it with suction or perturb it physically with these by roughening it, you do get the kind of scaling that comes up in the mathematics there. Okay, so that's what I wanted to say about that. And now I want to... No. It's hard enough to do the analysis with smooth, yeah, boundaries, yeah. Okay, now what about with boundaries and a body force? So the canonical example here would be Rayleigh-Binard convection, where the fluid is here, the buoyancy force is acting throughout, and there are boundary conditions that the fluid is confined and runs into these walls here. Of course, The control parameters is generally the Rayleigh number, which is some measure of the temperature drop or the buoyancy force divided by the damping coefficients. And the flux is measured in terms of the enhancement of heat flux across the layer, the Nusselt number there. And the big question in the business is, well, the Nusselt number is some function of the Rayleigh number. This is like current is a function of voltage here. Maybe does it scale? Does it scale simply? And if so, what is the scaling law? And so on. So a parenthetical remark in parentheses here is that Nusselt number, as is well known by identities, is usually proportional to epsilon. So I'm still talking about the energy dissipation rate, but here it's directly a current. Nusselt is Nusselt plus 1. Nusselt minus 1 is epsilon divided by Rayleigh Prandtl times something. But I mean, a bound on one is a bound on the other. Okay. Now, there are various incarnations of the convection problem with which we get various degrees of success. The simplest, physically simplest problem is porous medium convection. Porous medium convection, the velocity field, it's not Navier-Stokes, actually, but it's a convection problem. The temperature is advecting and diffusing in an incompressible velocity field, and the velocity field just obeys Darcy's law with respect to the temperature field. So the temperature field drives the velocity field, which then advects the temperature. So this is really a boiled down version of convection. The theoretical expectations for this model, well, if you want to think about a marginally stable boundary layer type argument or a Kolmogorov type scaling argument where the microscopic diffusion coefficients get renormalized away, so the heat transport has to become independent of thermal conduction, then in either case you will conclude, or you might guess, that the Nusselt number should be proportional to the Rayleigh number at high Rayleigh number. Well, the theorem is that the Nusselt number is indeed bounded above by a constant, which is small constant, about 0.25 or so, or 2.8, or maybe it's 0.35, times the Rayleigh number as Rayleigh goes to infinity. And the upper bound is actually very good right down to transition. Here is a data collected in a paper by Lister from 1990. He collected a whole bunch of different experimental data for porous medium convection. Porous medium convection is very difficult because Darcy's law type model breaks down at different places depending upon the pore scales, the pore size, and so on, and the type of fluid. So every experiment eventually breaks down. But you can see that there's a nice envelope here, and the theorem really goes right up to it. And the theorem, actually, the upper bound comes right down to the transition point and is actually slightly better than the leading order amplitude equation down there. So it's something that's quite good. That's considered a success for upper bounds there. Now let me go on to something slightly more complicated. Infinite Prandtl number convection. Infinite Prandtl number convection still doesn't have any inertial terms in the Navier-Stokes equations, but I've got regular old viscosity. It's not Darcy's law anymore. It's a Stokes type driving. So again, the buoyancy is driving the velocity field, which is advecting the temperature there. Now here, if you apply a marginally stable boundary layer argument, or if you require a finite but non-zero heat transfer into a semi-infinite layer, then you get this classical scaling exponent. You might guess that Nusselt goes like Rayleigh to a third is the answer. Well, the best bound we can get is Nusselt goes like Rayleigh to a third as an upper bound with logarithmic enhancement. So we're logarithmically within this behavior here. And in fact, I'll put that up. This really messes your slides up, right? When you say again. No lower bounds. No, because the lower bound is Nusselt equals 1, because there's an exact solution which has Nusselt equals 1, so I could never prove that all solutions are above, solutions are above that, right? It's unstable, but it's there, yeah. A variation on this, which is kind of interesting, is infinite Prandtl number convection with rotation. In this case, we consider that we're rotating the system around the axis, which is the gravity axis, the vertical axis there. Now, the Taylor-Proudman intuition for a problem like this is that rotation ought to suppress convection, ought to suppress the vertical motions, which is the convection. And the theorems here, and Peter and his students and postdocs have really been pushing this for the last couple of years, are that the Nusselt number is bounded above by different kinds of bounds depending upon the Taylor number here. Now, what we have here is there's always a 2/5 bound, which is uniform in rotation. There's also a 1/3 bound, but its constant gets bad as the rotation increases. And then there's a horrible Rayleigh squared bound, but it goes to zero as the rotation increases. So you do get the suppression of rotation, but in a kind of subtle way here, at least in the bounds here. The infinite Prandtl number. Infinite Prandtl number. Yeah, with rotation, we can't do anything with rotation for... Could you hold that, please? What am I doing here? All right, good. So the picture here is this. There's always a two-fifth bound which is uniform in rotation. There's a, for a low rotation, the one-third bound is good. But as the rotation increases, the prefactor increases, and the one-third bound starts increasing. But then there's this horrible Rayleigh squared bound, but it decreases as the rotation increases. So as the rotation increases, you'll have, at least in the bounds, a Rayleigh squared part, then a two-fifths part, and a one-third part. That's right, the minimum of all those things. It all changes. It'll change with rotation, these crossover points, at least in the bounds. Whether they're physical is a big open question. Okay. Okay, how about regular old normal fluid convection, right? Here's the arbitrary problem. Arbitrary Prandtl number problem. It's got everything in here. Theoretical expectations. A lot of people believe that Nusselt goes like Rayleigh to the alpha, and alpha is somewhere between a quarter and a half, maybe with logarithms, and maybe with various Prandtl number dependences. Or some people also believe that you're always crossing over from one scaling regime to another. That would be the Grossmann-Loza theory, which is around now. In other words, I would say that there's no consensus in theory as to what one should expect here. Experimental DNS expectations. Some people would say alpha, its exponent is somewhere between a quarter and a half. Maybe there are some logarithmic corrections and there's various Prandtl number dependencies. Or I think we heard from Günter Ahlers, we're going to hear from him today, that maybe there are continuous crossovers between scaling regimes. I think it's fair to say that there's no experimental consensus on what we should be expecting here. That is an excellent observation. That's right. Theory and experiment do agree. They're in consensus here. Yeah. There is the theorem for this. The theorem is the one thing that we can all be sure of in this problem. Only it seems only marginally relevant right now to all of the experiments and all of the theories. There's a Nusselt goes like Rayleigh to the one-half bound, which for statistically stationary flows was proven by Howard in 63 and then Peter and I redid this in 96 without any statistical assumptions. This is uniform in Prandtl number. We haven't been able to improve this at all. We've worked very hard to try to get other things. If we put assumptions in, we can get various exponents. We make assumptions. But if we don't make assumptions, this seems to stand there. I'm not saying it's bad. I've seen experimental data from reputable people, right? And as we know, there are some people who say that the one half is there. There's some, right? And they believe it still, and there are people who don't. I'm not defending anything. All right. So let me conclude and, yep. Perfect. Timing, yeah? Okay. So, conclusions. Well, first of all, the observation is that turbulence seems to saturate the mathematical bounds in some cases, convection being the exception. The analysis that we can do now is capable of producing physical scaling, but also reasonable prefactors. We can compute things that are quite reasonable. In the porous medium convection, for example, it's excellent. So that would be one particular case. I think we will all agree, and in fact, there will be much discussion during this century about Rayleigh-Bernard convection. It's a challenge for everybody. I think it's a challenge for experiments, it's a challenge for theory, and it's a challenge for analysis. For example, with the analysis, which I can talk about most comfortably, our exponent, I think, may, well, the exponent doesn't seem to It seems to be way above all the experiments except for a few experiments. We have no Prandtl number dependence, and there seems to be a Prandtl number dependence. We don't know what the domain dependence is and so on, so there's a lot of room there. A big challenge remaining for upper bound theory is what to do with open flows. All the flows I talked about were flows in bounded domains, except for the first one where you can take the infinite volume limit. But let's say flow past the sphere, turbulent wake. I would like to know the drag force. We know that the Stokes drag is an absolute minimum on the force that an object feels in a flow field like this. We would like to see that there's a bound for the turbulent drag, which goes like u squared. Well, it's independent of viscosity. Rho u squared times the square of the radius times the area there. This would be a nice result because it would confirm what's in all the textbooks and what everybody believes. However, the best known estimate right now goes back to Hopfen 41. It's horrible. It's e to the Reynolds number type bound. So it's really lousy. But there's room to do something there, too. Okay, so that's, I'll finish and we can discuss and take a break. Thanks. Well, it has to do with, for example, some operators having continuous spectrum instead of discrete spectrum. I mean, technically, are the reasons. It actually has to do. No. This ought to be true, but we don't know how to prove it yet. It's separation. Yeah. Now, there's a theorem by Xiaoming Wang, a recent theorem. He generalized what Peter and I did. If you have a bounded domain with smooth boundaries and the boundary conditions are purely shearing on the boundaries, then you have epsilon goes like u cubed over L, where L is an appropriate length scale for the domain and u is an appropriate velocity scale. However, if you try to apply that here, put this in a big box, you find that you get factors of the volume out in front. And so you don't have a good infinite volume limit. On the other hand, if you try to reformulate this in a way where you can sort of apply his techniques, you find out that you have to have some suction. You have to transform the problem and you get some suction. You don't just have shearing boundary conditions. And this has also to do with separation and things like this. But that's where the analysis breaks down right now. It's technical, but yeah. Mm-hmm. It's still mathematically, I still have the problem. Yeah. Right. And I can't do that either. No. It does. We can't do it either way. Yeah. In some cases, we can justify it. In some cases, we can justify it, meaning that the bounds agree with the predictions of that argument. And in some cases, the bounds don't agree with the predictions of that argument. In the cases where it does, we're very happy. In the cases where it doesn't, well, that's life. No, not at all. Well, for example, the marginally stable boundary layer theory says if you apply it to convection naively, regular convection, you get a third. If you apply it in more sophisticated ways, you might get 2/7. But then more sophisticated ways means you're making lots of assumptions about this, that, and the other. But Srini doesn't believe 2/7 is correct, so.
All right, let us thank Charlie for a crystal clear representation. And okay.